Carla Sumala. Some of you may have been here at the earlier Bible study. I see some familiar faces. I did sort of a pinch hit this morning for Julia Fogg. So this is my sort of second time on deck today. What I'm going to be working on this week at Luther College. What I will be doing in Holden with you this week is a study of religious pluralism in America, and taking a look at the issue of religious pluralism, particularly through the use of case studies, as opposed to sort of lecture or presentation. Case studies give us the opportunity to really jump into the material and engage with the actors who are engaged in real life situations created by difference, particularly religious difference. There's all kinds of issues around difference today in the United States. And I think it's probably the most pressing question that we are facing in our country today. We've seen it throughout the elections and in the aftermath. What do we do with difference? Right? And it can be difference of any kind. Politicians are asking that question. Teachers and students are asking that question. School districts, how do we handle difference in our schools, whether it's difference in language, difference in training, all kinds of issues of difference. We're asking it in our churches and religious communities. How do we handle difference? As a society, we're also asking that bigger question, how do different religious communities, people of faith, live right next to each other, live with each other, with these differences? Diana Eck, in a wonderful book, she published it first in 1993. It's called From Bozeman to Benares. She's a religion scholar at Harvard. And in this book, From Bozeman to Benares, she traces her own religious path from growing up in Montana to working at Harvard in comparative religions and running something called the Pluralism Project at Harvard, and all of her travels and journeys that along the way. At any rate, she wrote this book in 1993. It did so well that she was republished in 2003 with a new preface. It's something that I'd recommend to anyone. It's a great read. She points out in that text, in her introduction, she asks, why must religious differences be so divisive? Is that the only option that we have, is to fight with each other or to merely tolerate each other, right? So is that the best we can do, is not hurt each other? Which in some cases is a good, is something to shoot for. At any rate, that exploration of how we live with difference, perhaps beyond the level of toleration, how can we get to the point of celebrating difference, learning from our differences, particularly within the religious arena? So that's what we're going to be examining this week. The setup that I've put together is, starting today, we are going to be using some clips from a video called Divided We Fall, right? And it's really interesting and fairly new. America in the Aftermath, and it was produced primarily by a college student named Valerie Cower, a Stanford University student, who after September 11th, set out on the road. She left school that fall. She was 20 years old with her cousin, went out on the road to take a look at what was happening in American cities after September 11th. The other stories that we didn't always hear in the news, right? Particularly where religions came into conflict with each other. She, as she'll describe, is a Sikh, so S-I-K-H, an Indian tradition, and the Sikh population was very much targeted after 9/11. They're often easily recognizable, especially the men, for their turbans and beards. And what seems to have happened in the film, further described, we won't get to all of it, we'll just do a couple selections, is that particularly after 9/11, through media images and other sound bites that we were getting, turban became equivalent with terrorism. So turban equals terrorist. And many American Sikhs were targeted. Many, in fact, were killed, murdered, out of revenge killings. So that's the first case that we're going to take a look at this week. We'll kind of get the background for this film, and then we'll get to the one case. So we're going to do some discussion along the way. And some of the things I'd like us to think about are, is the situation in the United States today any different than it was right after 9/11? Right? Have things changed a lot? In what way? How are things in your community, especially when we're dealing with issues of religious difference? Is it an issue in your community? For some places in America, dealing with religious pluralism is not yet on the radar. I teach at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and many of my students are from small rural communities where diversity means Catholic and Lutheran. And maybe a Baptist church. That's diversity. In Decorah, we are our most exotic, different communities are the Unitarian Universalists. So, you know, you kind of have this sense. But that's changing too. Even in small town America, there are people of many faiths who are living alongside each other, sometimes comfortably, sometimes not so comfortably. And so those are some of the things that we're going to be taking a look at. What I'd like to do is just kind of get us started. This will take about, I think, 9 or 10 minutes to get us into this idea. We'll stop and talk about it. Then we'll jump on to the case of the first sort of revenge killing, is what it's called, after 9/11. It took place on September 15th, 2001, in Mesa, Arizona, where the owner of a gas station, a Sikh man, was murdered simply for being Sikh. He had a turban on and was targeted as such. And talk a little bit about that, how that happened, what kinds of things were at play. We'll also take a look at the response of the community in Mesa. And we actually have folks here from the Phoenix area who might be able to provide some additional insight as to their own experience, what they remember of this event, or if they do. It's kind of interesting because I, before reading or seeing this film, I didn't know that this happened. All right, this was not part of the news that made it to me in Iowa, or if it did, it was probably a really tiny little piece, because if you remember, our news reports, newspapers, television, after September 11th was all about Twin Towers and planes and all those sorts of things. The other stories were largely lost to us. And in some ways, it's pretty startling. So I'll get this going.
My name is Valerie. I am an American. I am a Sikh. I am a student, away at school, living in my books. All day long, I read about ethics, religion, violence, law. It can get a little depressing, reading about all the reasons why people kill each other. I guess that's why I can't let myself forget what I learned on the road. There, I found the deeper truth. Stories can save us. Stories can bind us, can break us open, can make us human to each other. But there's also the politics of storytelling. Who decides what stories are told and which are buried? Who is framing the picture? Who is holding the camera? In the aftermath of September 11th, I took my camera across the country to find the stories you were not hearing and the faces you were not seeing. This is a story about my journey and the question, who counts as American? In a world divided into us and them, who counts as one of us? What does an enemy look like? What does an American look like? 100 years ago, this is what my grandfather looked like. My understanding of America begins with him. My father's father was Kehar Singh. In 1947, 1913, he left all he had in India and traveled by steamship to the Pacific shores of America, in a time when Indian didn't refer to people actually from India. With little English, he eventually built his new life in Clovis, California, a farming town near Fresno in the Central Valley. My father was born on this land, and so was I. My dad would tell me stories about my grandfather, the pioneer.
Then they worked their way down from San Francisco. Farmers would let them live in barns, and at first they were a little bit hesitant to give them work because they looked so different, and he felt the need to become citizens in the United States. He always loved this country. He had this white Ford, I remember when I was growing up, and I would ride with him, and the kids would chase after the truck yelling, "Santa Claus, Santa Claus." So I was just really proud, like, here's my dad, and everybody's yelling, you know, thinking he's Santa Claus. And now, you know, you see a lot of people with turbans and beards. In those days, I was the only Indian at my high school, the entire high school. So you can imagine my dad having a white beard, a really white beard, and wearing a turban. He was very distinctive, and people really liked him, and he knew everybody in town.
If he hadn't had the turban on, I think he would have noticed him anyway. The Constitution of the United States is based on the millennium rules, and I think that benefited Clovis because when you love the land and the order of it, you have a more common will to make sure your neighbor does okay, because if they're doing okay, you're doing okay. So we have an all-American ethnic group here in Columbus. It was a lovely time of all-America. It was an excellent time. It is now, but it is different.
This was Clovis when my grandfather came. And this is Clovis now. The story of Clovis is the story of America, once a farming community where everyone knew everyone, now an expanding suburbia with many walls and many, many churches. When I was going to school, my friends and teachers tried very hard to convert me to Christianity. If I wasn't saved, they told me, my entire family would burn in eternal hellfire, and it would be my fault. This is when my other grandfather taught me about my family's religious tradition, Sikhism.
In Kuala Sikhi, several others, as brother, and do worship, remember God all the time, every moment, every sadhya, every look you take, remember God.
Sikhism is one of the youngest major world religions. There are 500,000 Sikhs in America and 23 million worldwide. The turban is worn by Sikhs as religious attire, like the Jewish yarmulke or the Muslim veil. In fact, nearly every person who wears a turban in America is Sikh. Although there are twice as many Sikhs as Jewish people in the world, none of my friends or even my teachers had ever heard of my religion. So my grandfather would sit me down and tell me how it all began. This is how it went. In the year 1469, in the region of Punjab, now India and Pakistan, an ordinary man named Nanak saw Hindus and Muslims around him divided against each other. Nanak disappeared by the river for 3 days and emerged with a vision of unity. Ik Omkar, God is one. All religions lead to one divine truth. He began teaching that all people are equal and that every person can realize God here and now through loving and serving their communities. Guru Nanak became the first of 10 teachers whose disciples were named Sikhs, students of truth. The 10th teacher, Guru Gobind Singh, organized Sikhs into a community of saint soldiers, given the duty to stand up and fight injustice. He gave Sikhs 5 articles of faith to seal their commitment, most visibly long uncut hair, which men and some women wrap in a turban. Most Sikhs, like both my grandfathers, wear turbans, while some, like my father, don't. The devotional poetry of the Gurus is contained in the Guru Granth Sahib, a living guide. Sikhs pray and meditate on these verses in a Gurdwara. Now, there was a Gurdwara in my hometown, but as a third-generation American girl, I didn't exactly fit in. All the other kids had names like Simranjeet and Amardeep. Their parents were Indian immigrants, and their dads wore Sikh turbans. My name was Valerie, and my dad dressed like Indiana Jones before there was So I was too American at the Gurdwara, and too Sikh at school. But that was okay, because at home, I was surrounded by a big family with many younger cousins, including Sunny, who drove me crazy from as far back as I can remember. I was inquisitive from the start. Note the camera. My childhood experiences led me to study religion and violence in college. I studied the power of ideology, the trauma of massacre, the need for healing, but always in the distant past, through other people's memories.
Three apparently deliberate and aerial assaults.
What attracted me to this film, and especially to this introduction as she moves through, is this sort of first-person narrative. She tells her story in the context of all these other stories. You get a sense of the storyteller, of Valerie, a 20-year-old college student who's trying to make sense of the world she lives in, of the America she lives in. One of the lines that seems so American to me is when she says that she was too American for her Gurdwara, her Sikh community, and too Sikh for her American high school. And I remember as a child my grandmother telling me the same thing. My grandmother is second generation Finnish, and her first language though was Finnish, and she said, when I go to Finland I'm an American, and when I'm in America I'm Finnish. I don't have a home. She didn't quite fit, and I think so many of us can tell those same stories. Clovis, California, where you have this grouping of people from all over the world who came in the early 1900s to try to make a go of this new world, to try to, especially through agriculture, and they worked together. There were bumps, and there were good times, there were bad times, but somehow this community made it go. And I think that is one of those very typically American stories. I just want to think for a moment and ask you if there are similarities between Clovis or between Valerie's experience, if there's anything that you relate to in the America that you experience. Are there stories of your community that are similar, ones built on immigration, change, difference? Are there communities? Is there anything that you could relate to?
Being Catholic at Olden Village.
Being Catholic at Olden Village. Yeah, it's kind of a, and where's the place where you'd feel at home, where perhaps a Lutheran would feel the same way? Do you have a community of...
In Italy.
All right. Yeah. Other experiences.
I live in Southern California outside Los Angeles, and it's much more diverse than it used to be. And one of the things I sense is some like hostility to the Mexican people that are moving into the LA area. A lot of, in the white community.
So it's kind of, those are the barriers, the strongest ones that are up.
The strongest, ethnic.
What kinds of barrier? What kind of hostility do you notice when you kind of recognize it as that?
The one thing you hear a lot is they just come over here and they get free medical care and this and that. But like I'm reading Rick Steves' book on travel as a political act, and since San Salvador, he talks about people living off the garbage, 10 foot 10-story-high garbage dump. And, you know, if I were living there, too, I would probably be coming over the border, do anything I could.
To survive and to feed your children and keep a roof over their heads.
Yeah.
So it kind of is an interesting, and you're pointing to, in some ways, the causes for all this change in America. Why do people come? Why has this movement happened? Is it because they hate their homes? No. You know, looking for opportunities. Other communities.
I live on Whidbey Island.
Okay.
And most of the families that chart their ancestry to Whidbey Island came there in the 20th century.
Right.
And all of them had some ethnic group that they, culture that they brought with them and that they celebrated in this new foreign place. And there are those who say, well, we're Swedes or we're or whatever. But the new ethnic division is as the island becomes kind of populated, the new ethnic division is those who were born there and those who are not. And so even people who have lived there for 70 years are maybe not discriminated, but they certainly know that they're not Whidbey Islanders. Because they weren't born there.
So you could have lived basically your entire life, but you can't say, I'm from Whidbey.
Right.
Yeah, in terms of gaining the right to be able to say that.
I won't tell a long story. I'm Jewish and I've been coming to Holden for 31 years. We immigrated from Brazil, my family and me, and we went to a small town in Washington. And when we first got there, people took paint on our house and ran over my brother's bike and called the police. Are we here legally? And that was not my experience. When I was able to understand, I was very accepted. But what broke my heart was when I was in high school, we had an influx of Vietnamese kids. And same thing happened to them. Their houses were firebombed. And I think what it all comes to is what I'm trying to teach my kids is different cool, not different scary. You know what I mean? It's just this, our reaction is different. That's all it comes down to, is just saying, different, that's interesting, let's learn about that, as opposed to we have this biological sort of deep reaction to different, ooh, scary. So
it's almost as if, are there Whidbey Island cells now that you gain over time?
Well, I've actually learned about that, like in fishing community, in schools of fish, they don't want different. You know, there's kind of a biological reaction to things that are different because of safety.
Right.
But I found that my kids could really learn different cool. It wasn't that hard to teach that idea. Different, let's go find out about that instead of different.
So it can be learned.
Absolutely.
It can be learned.
I'm from Mesa, Arizona, where Sing Sodhi was killed. It was the first murder mm-hmm. of its kind after 9/11. But I grew up in Mesa, a Catholic in a Mormon, mm-hmm. a very large Mormon community. We're the Mexicans that were in Arizona when it was Mexico. We never immigrated. when we grew up, our parents told us we were Americans. They were born here. My grandparents, our great-grandparents, we were all born here. We didn't come from Mexico, even though we were of Mexican heritage. But we would go to school and we would say, what are you? Well, we're Americans. And then they would say, no, you're not. You're Mexican. So we never had the right to call ourselves what we were. We were Americans of Mexican descent. But when they said Mexican, they always preceded Mexico with dirty Mexican. And this was back in the 50s. So that term Mexican already had a negative connotation. And now, 40 years later, Singh Sodhi is killed in Mesa. And now the majority of people, the majority is Mexicans from Mexico. So that whole hostility against Mexican has really grown in light of what she's saying. There's you probably heard of our famous sheriff, Joe Arpaio. Mm-hmm. And we have more racist organizations in Arizona than anywhere else, becoming the new Alabama. So we're dealing with that hate and hostility against Mexicans and Latin Americans, who the majority are Christians, right? They're
right.
Family-oriented, they're Christian, they're church-going people, but the people that are the most hostile against them are
other
Christians.
So you've got difference in all, working itself in so many ways, so it's almost as if you became Mexican over time. You were American, and the need to attach a label to you and kind of disinherit you.
Exactly. That's where the term Chicano was born, because we never felt we were really Mexican, because we weren't from Mexico.
Right.
And we were never allowed to be American. We couldn't even call ourselves American. They wouldn't let us. So the term Chicano was came out of that, and that was a term we called ourselves, and that we still use to this day.
So that idea of, she talks a lot about in her interviews with people, talking to people, and people, especially among Sikhs as well as others, the statement that they'll receive most frequently is just, go home to where you're from. And she says, but Clovis is where I don't have any other home. And the same thing here is like, go home to, this is home. Yeah, that idea, what is home? Yeah.
I have a community story, but to preface a little bit on top of what Zarco said, I find it real ironic living in California that there are so many people who are adverse to Mexican or people of Spanish descent coming to San Diego, San Francisco,
San Jose.
It's a kind of an ironic situation, but we do live in California, and prior to Pearl Harbor, you know, at the time when Valerie's grandfather was settling in Clovis, there were lots of Japanese immigrants settling in California, born in California, making a life in California, and like 9/11, and maybe even worse, were the internment camps that came out of the Pearl Harbor situation, and Japanese all along the coast and all across America were gathered and imprisoned in internment camps for many years.
She actually does an interview with a group from people who'd lived as children or young adults, and now they're in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and talks about that experience. And they said, you know, they said, we were American, we didn't know anything different, this is where we lived, and all of a sudden we were being put on buses and told that we weren't American. I think that's one of the key questions she asks. What does an American look like? What does an American look like? We all have our ideas. Maybe a good way to start with that question is, what does an American look like in the most common images we see in our media? What does an American look like in terms of visual images? What comes up in our films? And TV and commercials.
White.
But it's also true in Spanish language television.
Right.
If you watch Spanish language television, you don't see brown people, you see Anglos about 90% of the time.
Very blonde.
Yeah.
What other images? So Caucasian or
farmer,
white?
Farmer, rancher, cowboy.
Yeah, like a true American. Yeah, farmer, rancher, cowboy. Other images?
Good, well-educated, and good-looking. I think our personal vision of an American is who we see in the mirror.
Right. So I'm an American, which means you can't be if you don't look like me. Almost, you know, that sense. Other images that are really dominant.
I think of the historic pilgrims and founding fathers, you know, the English that came, that culture that started us.
That's right. So
they're the Americans.
Americans.
On the $1 bill again and again and again.
The Americans, yeah.
The light-skinned blacks, like Beyoncé.
Right.
Those are the blacks you see are the very, very light-skinned.
Right, so if you want to be, you can be an American black if you're light-skinned.
Right.
Well, I'd argue that our presidents and their presidents' spouses personify America.
Yeah.
And now we have a new
picture
that is really shaking up everything.
A lot of images, because it just doesn't fit with 200 plus years of dominant images.
I would suggest, though, that it depends on the media that you observe. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you watch progressive media, like, say, Sesame Street or something, mm-hmm. that it will be painstakingly balanced, mm-hmm. that there will always be a black, an Asian, and an Anglo, a white. And so, like, the media, the advertisements that the Lutheran College has put out is painfully balanced, you know, so the Lutheran College stuff won't look too Norwegian.
Although it is. So we make sure our image in our documentation is very strategic, but when you walk onto campus and any student, international student or American student of color who walks in onto our campus says, dang, this place is white.
Yeah.
That's what we hear day in, day out.
I think the main thing that makes you American is you don't have an accent.
Oh, you don't have accents. Yeah, if you have an accent.
Meaning, I don't know what. Isn't there, don't media personalities have to speak a certain...
Peter you James. Don't have a foreign accent. Yeah, you don't have a foreign accent. Yeah, my husband gets that all the time. So you're not from here. You're not from here. And you know, it's like, what does that mean? He says, I live more than my half my life in the United States, trained in the United States. You know, but that sense that he says, I can get my citizenship, but nobody will ever consider me an American.
I think another common image is whether it's the senator, the House of Representatives, the CEO, the bankers, that even the French premier is the white guy in the suit and tie.
Right.
White That's male. Pretty common.
White male.
And then I think because of the war on terrorism, it's the general, the people in uniforms. Mm-hmm. And so it's those authority figures that we look to for a feeling of stability or respect or whatever.
Or definition, even.
Yeah. Who we are.
Right. I guess, and so in terms of that idea of what an American looks like, although it's pretty amorphous, you know, it's hard to pin down, people have that idea because that language is used. Well, you're not an American. So that people have a pretty strong idea of what that is. And they're deciding daily in the United States who is and who isn't. And it seems to be a pretty big concern. All right? Often, to be an American, in the conversations I've had with people, you need to be a Christian. Yes. Well, if you're not a Christian, then you're not an American.
And a certain kind of Christian.
A certain kind of Christian, to boot. So there are all sorts of pieces. I guess, and she asked the question after, what does an American look like? What does an enemy look like? What does an enemy look like in terms of the images that come to our mind, the images that we see most frequently? What kinds of attributes are attached to enemy?
Criminals are black.
Black, yes. So dark color is attached
and
to...
Mostly male.
Male, dark, others? Images that are attached to the enemy.
The poor?
The poor, yeah. Say a little bit more that why the poor? Because they're...
Well, I think people tend to think that they're leeching off
okay.
of everybody else. They're taking advantage of everybody else. And of course, you know, we know that they're being scapegoated.
Right.
And we tend to pick on the weakest amongst
link.
Us.
So the poor, because they're leeching off of us, they're stealing. So that's the enemy. And she talked about Clovis now, a very sort of, she didn't use the word gated, but that was the image. You see all these homes, and they're gated. So if you ask who's living in those gated communities, I would bet that they're not particularly diverse. All right, so you want to keep your kind in and the poor out. And so that poor is an enemy. Yes?
I think if you're angry,
angry, yes. If you show any kind of anger, you can be, you're an enemy, you know. And certain types of people. If you're poor and you're black and you're angry, you're an enemy. What other images?
About a year after 9/11, I was on an airplane, and I was sitting next to a person who was reading like a little prayer book in mm-hmm. a Middle Eastern script. And, you know, I didn't think I was in a real terrified frame of mind after 9/11, but I mean, I shouldn't have reacted this way, but sitting next to him, I was terrified. I thought this plane was going to go down. You know, and I should not have had that reaction.
I would say the enemy could be anything that's, if we're talking about difference, different from who we imagine the American. So the different religion, the different color, the different accent, kind of the, anything that's different from what we described previously.
Well, after 9/11, I think it was it Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell who said that this is a result, and he gave a long list, gays, feminists.
Right.
So if women get to be too uppity, they're the enemy. So you, anybody who's not that, white male.
Just about what she said, in the blockbuster movie Iron Man,
right,
the enemies are the Middle Eastern men with turbans.
With turbans, which is so interesting. It's like we want to put a visual thing on them.
Well, I like what the gentleman said about kind of think our vision of presidents changing.
Right.
I think in the mid-90s, there was an interesting case study where Timothy McVeigh, a Midwestern white male, was an enemy just because he had an idea about the politics of our country and how that was going.
You know, my boys, when they were teenagers, and the way they dressed, the way they looked, they looked like gangbangers. They're scary looking. Even to me, they were. they're intimidating looking. I mean, even to me, right? They're my kids. But after Columbine, I was afraid of young white males.
Young, angry white males.
Yeah, I was afraid of them for the first time. I always thought that they were the friendly ones, and then all of a sudden they became the enemy.
So somebody does something, and you look for the type.
Right.
Right.
I think the enemy can be who your parents told you the enemy is.
Who you learn about the enemy, because often enemies are learned.
Yeah.
More often than not.
Right. Uh-huh. Zealots.
Zealots. Yeah, we get worried about zealots.
I do get worried about
zealots. Anybody that threatens the status quo. It's like I live in Seattle, and to find a Republican that you can talk to rationally is very difficult. And I happen to work with a national board of business people.
That's from the country.
So one of my board members, who's technically one of my bosses as a nonprofit executive, sent an email around about the concern about Obama being a socialist. And basically, this is like the last-ditch effort before the election,
right,
to try and discredit this person, was going to tear down all this capitalist structure that we have grown to love and know that is a core part of. So, I mean, they're inciting that fear that this guy is going to take everything we built up and we've been protecting with our fear and our cronyism and all this stuff. And he forwarded that to me and a couple other people, and I didn't respond because he's one of my bosses. But that whole idea that there's somebody who's different than us, who's going to take away our guns, our whatever, and our safety.
He's going to take away our safety, yeah.
Our sense of safety.
26% of our school population in Rochester, Minnesota is now diverse.
Right.
But I came in 1961 to teach that it's not true at all. So there's resentment there because these people are taking so much of the funds to bring them up to par, and they're not able to raise a standard that much, and so there's a resentment there, and then there's groups that do not want to assimilate at all. So there's a real struggle.
Well, there's an expectation that they have to assimilate.
Yeah.
You know, and why should they? It's kind of,
To what extent do you think most of these reactions depend on some fear that you don't notice differences when there aren't things to be afraid about?
You know, it's kind of interesting, and I think fear is, I think, ever present is my answer. And I think people have been afraid of difference. Sometimes I think it's heightened by certain events.
Right.
But I think there's always that fear of the other, and I think that's kind of what we're getting down to when we're looking at religious pluralism and why it's so particularly problematic in the United States, people's reactions to it, not the fact that we're a plural nation. That can be a very good thing. But the fact that religion often is the thing that we hold most dear, that is so core, it's the thing that doesn't change, it's the thing that we hold on to in hard times. And if we see that changing, or if we think that our religious traditions or beliefs are being threatened in any way, it goes back to status quo, don't touch my God. is what we want to sign up. Don't touch my God. Don't make me think differently about this. Partly out of fear, because if God can change, then where will we be? And I think that's a real anxiety-provoking.
One of the things that has kind of puzzled me is the fact that our health is based on an immune system which recognizes something that is different mm-hmm. just coming to our system.
Yeah.
To what extent is that not part of our biological makeup? That we, anytime there's something strange, we react to it automatically. I don't know that we can do anything other than kind of train ourselves not to.
And I think we almost have to, and that's the education piece.
Well, I was just kind of thinking that same, along those same lines, you know, if you think back biologically and evolutionary, and evolutionarily, I mean, plus, most of us, not all of us, but most of us are visual learners.
Right.
And biologically and evolutionarily, we're, you know, people or our animals react to what they see. And so if you see someone that looks different than you with a turban or a different color of skin or something, you know, and you're untrained or you haven't learned to know that, you know, there's deeper things that are more important, then that's kind of a biologic, I don't know.
So we've got two things going on here. We've got the sense of difference and then empathy in some ways with people who fear. You know, we've got these two sides of the coin. We'll take one last comment, and then we'll take a look at our next clip.
I would say the next step, to what was said over there about biologically, I think historically humans are tribal people mm-hmm. that needed to protect mm-hmm. their possessions. And so I think there is a certain innate feeling there that needs to be educated against. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, my son is an athlete. He's sitting behind me. And, you know, he goes to war for his school against, you know, this school and that school. And so at the same time, we're trying to teach, you know, assimilation and learning from differences. We are also teaching kind of subliminally that, you know, those guys are the enemies.
Our tribe against your tribe.
Exactly.
What we're going to move on now is to that specific incident in Mesa, Arizona, and we'll take a look at that. Takes a minute to... There we go.
First, we have some developments in an attack that happened right
here.
This
involves a member of the Sikh community.
Very well be the country's fourth deadly act of misplaced revenge to Tuesday's attack on America.
This shooting incident immigrated to the U.S. and Phoenix looking for a better life.
In hate crime right here in the valley.
The gas station owner was gunned down in cold blood by a man who may have targeted him because he's wearing a turban.
This is a violent shot.
Some years think Sogi was well known and well liked in the neighborhood surrounding his convenience store.
A shame that this is the first thing to show ignorance and stupidity.
Landscaping guy there. My brother talking to landscaping guy. Somebody bring their car behind my brother and shoot 5 times in the back. He went to with us to Topaz Airport. He said, I want to spend more time with my children. And that's the last time I saw him at the airport. So what, he's no more. And that's just like a terrible moment of my life, and I couldn't believe that.
One hour before his death, he went to Costco and gave $74 to the New York victims. Whatever in his pocket, he gave all of his money to the New York victims. 1 hour before his death, he called me about 2 o'clock. He said, bring me a couple of American flags. I want to put on the store.
Media people come to me and ask me, what do you feel about America? I said, why you ask me this question? Why you not think we are American? Why you put those two words to separate? Because we are American also.
I was scared by all of that when I heard it. And then I was like freaking out, like, what the heck is going on?
The thing that stands out the most to me on that day, right after the shootings occurred, when me and my wife went down to be with the Sikh community, is looking into the faces of the children and to realize what must be going on in their minds. And so together, as the Arizona Interfaith Movement, we really are committed to stand against hate and intolerance.
During this high holy day season for Jews, when we are compelled by our tradition to look within, to search our souls, and to determine what our future will be, I thought it was important to be with the members of the Sikh community this morning.
The guilt by association is not the right thing. Racism is not right. Prejudices are not right. We have to eliminate prejudices. We have to eliminate the hate. We have to bring love, peace, and harmony.
Being a Christian, I really feel like God will always bring something good out of a tragedy anyway, so.
This is Nolan's letters, some of the Nolan's letters to the community and to the family. And this one, it says, a few days ago, I read in horror about what happened to Mr. Sodhi. I choked back tears as I read that Mr. Sodhi was trying to find a flag to fly at his business. With this letter, I have sent two items which are priceless to me. This flag was used to honor my father at his funeral. He served in the U.S. Army for 21 years. During this time, he worked as a medic in Korea and during 2 rotations in Vietnam. In my eyes, your father deserves his flags as much as any soldier. He had courage to go to work in spite of the danger posed by the ignorance of others. He was good and he was kind, and in my opinion, he served our country as faithfully as my father.
It's always tough. You can't forget your family member is gone. And life is very tough. This should not be happening anymore to anybody. Look at my sister-in-law. She wants to stay with his whole life without him. That's so painful.
Gobir Sodhi's widow, Harjinder Kaur, was in India. For 12 years, they had lived on opposite sides of the world so that he could work in America and send money home. She came here for his funeral, but returned before I could speak with her.
There were 2 brothers that were horrific in and of themselves, but were also looked at together, I think.
That very briefly outlines the story of Balbir Sodhi in Mesa, Arizona. And there are further details about this. There are, you know, all kinds of things. Towards the end of this film, to give a little bit away, which was also shocking to me, his brother was killed less than a year later in another killing that was similar. So you think the unthinkable happens not just once, it happens twice to the same family. So you have this whole extended family in the Sikh community who, because of their religious practices, really, this is what identifies them, and the way they look, are targeted.
I think this brings to mind the fact that, you know, we're obsessed, America's obsessed with this idea of assimilating. They want everybody to assimilate. Well, what does that mean? To all look the same? To act the same? All speak the same? Eat the same food? Because the Sikhs, they're not going to assimilate. They're not going to change the way they look. People from Mexico aren't going to stop being Mexican. They love their culture. They love their heritage. But they love America just as much. That's why they come here. But somehow we can't separate the two.
It's just like in the interview, and he says, people ask us what we think about America. And he says, well, why are you asking me that? I'm an American. that sense, why can't I be an American? You know, and the sense is, and there are other points in the film where some of the Sikh men say, I could take my turban off and shave my beard, he said, I'm still not going to look like an American, whatever that means. But that sense is, why can't they, and it's always the us and them, look like us? You know, assimilate, look, be different than who you are.
I heard somewhere, instead of using the analogy of a melting pot, to use a salad bowl, because nobody's ever going to be the same like you are in a soup or in a pot, but in a salad, you're all different.
But you're part of the same, you're working towards the same ends. Yeah, and that's why he says, I'm an American. He had a convenience store, a gas station, as typically American as you get. We love our cars. That's, you know, sort of our lifeblood. And he provided that service that we all need.
Our community of Shelton, Washington is, we have a large Native American population. And for years, they were sort of the other. Mm-hmm. And now that they have been allowed to show pride in their own culture, and education is becoming important, and they're accepted, and it's really, you know, they're not the other anymore. And it's been a joy to watch that.
You had your hand up?
And I was going to say, the thing that scares me when I watch that and I cry with sensitivity and sympathy for that situation is to realize that there's a part of America, a pretty large part, that would be threatened by the ideas that is portraying that we should let our guard down, that you know, there are people who, you know, would rebel against what that's trying to teach us.
Yeah, that woman said, I think that God can work good through any tragedy. I think that depends on if we let God work through us, because like after 9/11, the world was with us, but then we had a president who capitalized, you know, got the country in a mode of being fearful. Once fear takes over, then that's not a good thing.
That one line of the woman saying, I think God, you know, says, I'm a Christian, I think God can bring good or uses situations to bring good about, is one Christian theology that not all Christians hold to. It can often be a very problematic theology. Does good have to come from everything? When I teach students at Luther College, I teach Judaism. That's one of my primary areas of research and study and teaching. And I think Americans, and I say Americans partly because I think it's our mindset, we want happy endings. We want things to turn out well. So I have had students write in essays that the Holocaust was bad, yes, but now look, Jews do just fine in the world. So maybe something good came of it. And I just say, there's something wrong with trying to find the good in evil. And that's what we see here. We don't need to find the good in evil. We can find that people, many who acted in profoundly kind ways, is a good thing. But it was not connected to the evil itself. So we have to be careful of that theology too. Maybe things happen and we don't have a reason for them.
And is that also connected to the people that will say, you know, when something bad happens, oh, the devil was in it.
We've got just about 3-4 minutes left, but yeah, that example, we're always trying to push it off. We either try to push evil off on the devil or try to find God in the middle of it. It's kind of an interesting sort of reaction that we have as human beings. Just as before we conclude here, any other reactions? I think a lot of this has generated some really powerful discussion, because I think that this is what it's about. Talking about the images, what other ways did this clip impact you? What came to mind? What did you feel? What did you think?
It just struck me how, and I didn't know, this is my own ignorance, and I'm relatively well-educated on religion as a clergy, I could have told you one thing about the Sikh religion. And so how ignorant we are of those around us to know that, I mean, not that we want to blame the Muslims either, but they're not even targeting, if they're trying to target the right religious group for this, they're often marked there.
There's a double problem. They didn't get the right group, but they shouldn't have been targeting that group in the first place. Yeah, other reactions. Yeah, right there.
I find it surprising that a lot of the people that we think are outsiders, not Americans, are practicing what we would call American ideals, more so than some of the rest of us. And the fact that he was going to get a flag and that he donated to, was it the Twin Tower Fund?
Right.
I mean, oh my
gosh. And he was an entrepreneur. And he was,
yes.
Yeah, that's what, those are American ideals. He did, he was it.
Yes.
Who else? Yeah, but we...
I'm puzzled about what I'm supposed to think about the perpetrator. Is that the typical American?
Yeah,
or
I don't know.
Is that another? How do we deal with the person who does that? I don't think that got addressed.
Not right there. She, because it's a 90-minute film, so, and there are further explorations. And she talks to different sense. Is there empathy with the perpetrator because you can feel their fear? Is there anger at the perpetrator? And if there's anger, why? You know, it's very complicated.
You know, because of our sheriff in Arizona, now you have, he's condoning the suppression, the persecution of particularly the Mexican. He's getting all this publicity, national, international. Mm-hmm. So now, more and more people are rallying behind him, and he's creating this whole anti-immigrant sentiment. And these are the type of people. They're the Minutemen. They call them the nativists, I think. They're the ones who are arming themselves to the teeth, and they want to kill somebody. Mm-hmm. They are going to kill somebody, and their enemy is very specific. It's people like myself and my family. We are their enemies. We're in harm's way simply by being there.
By existing.
By existing. And by being suspicious. Carmen calls it getting arrested for being...
No, DWB. Driving while brown. I'm a
so, I have friends that say that. Say it's like, oh, problems. It's kind of like shopping while brown.
Yeah. So that's for us, it's, our lives are in danger in Arizona. It's a very real threat to us.
Yep.
I wanted to say that the man that killed Balbir Sodhi was put in jail, and his trial was very publicized, and he had a lot of sympathizers, like the Minuteman and people who thought he was right, and he embodies the American ignorance. You know what I mean? Yes. He didn't even know how to tell the difference between a Sikh and an Arab, you know, and he did it out of anger, which is what we fear the most, is angry white men or angry people. Ignorant people with a gun. I think that. So to me, when you're talking about who's the enemy and who's American, okay?
Right.
I was thinking, for me, the American is the American Indian. Everybody else is an immigrant, and most of them illegals anyway. The pilgrims didn't have permission to. They didn't ask.
They were
permission.
Undocumented.
They were undocumented. Exactly. Then I think I am the enemy, because my husband and I and our family, we're all brown, and we are. That directed that anger, that ignorance we feel against.
And we're liberals too.
And oh yeah. and then I think that you know, who is the American symbol, you know?
is the killer of Bobby Sodi the symbol of America now? You know, people idolized him. They defended him. They thought, well, he's defending being American. And what does American mean?
There were some reactions that she brings up later, and that pointing out when they said, the person you killed is not a Muslim, and the perpetrator, as well as some of his supporters, said, well, it doesn't matter. It's people like them anyway.
Yes.
That was the reaction. There was no remorse. It was like, those people. I might not have gotten the right one today, but I would have had to get them eventually, was the sense.
They used to say, I've heard said, kill them, let God sort them out. You ever heard that?
Yeah. This is powerful stuff, and we could go on for a long time. Tomorrow won't be quite so heart-wrenching in some ways. But it's really interesting and something that I think all of us can relate to. The case study we're going to be looking at tomorrow is called Trouble in Troy, and it's taking a look at National Day of Prayer when people who aren't Christians and Jews decide to pray along with on this day, and the huge controversy that ensues when the organizers say, it's National Day of Prayer, but that means Jews and Christians only. The rest of you can't pray. So we'll take a look at that and kind of work along with that. Thank you very much for coming today.